ஓம் பூர்ணமத பூர்ணமிதம் பூர்ணாத் பூர்ணமுதச்யதே பூர்ணஸ்ய பூர்ணமாதாய பூர்ணமேவ வசிஷ்யதே. ஓம் சாந்தி சாந்தி சாந்தி. That invisible reality is the infinite. This visible universe too is the infinite. From that invisible infinite, this visible universe of infinite extension has come out. The infinite remains the same, even though the infinite universe has come out of it. Om, peace, peace, peace be unto all. The Upanishad is telling us that practice has to be combined with rituals or understanding. Practice very often divides people if there is no understanding by the side of it. So many followers of religions, we see that are quite sincere. They do practice and yet they do not hesitate to quarrel, to cut the throats of other people. Why is it so? Are they really insincere? No. So far as their practice is concerned, they are quite sincere. But the understanding behind is lacking. It is very surprising, not only ordinary people, but people who have attained to very great heights of spiritual progress too, commit this tremendous mistake. For example, Saint Francis of Assisi went to Turkey to convert people. The Sultan of Turkey was very wise man. He immediately recognized this man is a real saint. And he gave him permission to preach Christianity. But how come such a great mystic didn't have the insight that whom the Muslims call Allah is the same one whom Christians call as Jesus Christ? So what is lacking there? He had been having lot of spiritual experiences. He had visions of God. And yet the mind deceives us so much. It always makes us move along with the grooves in which we have been brought up. Hinduism is known for its liberality. From the time of the Vedas, the rishis, the seers have recognized that truth is one, but sages call it by various names. This is their realization, which would have brought about a tremendous change in everybody's concept. But then so many quarrels, so much of oppression, though to the credit of Hinduism, too much of bloodshed has not taken place. There were occasional skirmishes, a little bit of quarrels. And yet, psychologically, people used to hate each other, the Shaktas, the Vaishnavas and all that. Don't they know that they are all calling on the same God? The same God takes different forms. Or, to put it more accurately, different people think of the same reality in so many ways. So, in order to drill that truth into us, great people come into this world. Every time they try to tell us, don't quarrel with anybody. It is the same truth whom we are all trying to reach, including the science. Swami Vivekananda was great enough to say that science also is a way to the same truth. If a man be a real scientist, and who is a real scientist? He who is a sincere seeker of truth. The truth which we seek through the five sense organs is what we call the science. But even if a man sincerely seeks, there comes a point where he will discover that he has to go beyond this world itself. Somebody is objecting? So the Upanishad is trying to tell us that mere practice is not enough. That is good. Without practice, theory is useless. But understanding also is very necessary. So in our last class we discovered the Upanishad saying, into a blind darkness they enter, who are devoted to rituals, but into a greater darkness they enter, who engage in knowledge of deity alone. He who is aware that both knowledge and ignorance should be pursued together, overcomes death through ignorance, and obtains immortality through knowledge. Another great misunderstanding that comes through the practice of religion is that this world should be completely discarded. But Swami Vivekananda came to say, this world is not your enemy. It's a grand opportunity for you to go to the same God. In fact, the world acts both as a training ground and as a ripening of our spiritual wisdom. If any man claims that he has a vision of God, how do we know that he has a vision of God if he can't see God in this world? Because there cannot be two things called God and the world, two separate entities. This very world is nothing but God. So, Swami Vivekananda says, improve your worldly knowledge and enjoy this world. For a man of true mystic vision, this very world is revealed as Brahman. It is said of Swami Turiyananda, he was a great follower of path of knowledge, Advaitin, stern, uncompromising Advaitin. He started with the practice, this world is an illusion and Brahman alone is real. But when he died, just before his death, on his deathbed, he seemed to have proclaimed, Brahma Satyam, Jagat Satyam. Brahman is also true. This world is also true. This is what exactly Sri Ramakrishna had come to tell us. He says, Brahman and Shakti are completely one and the same. It is like a snake. If a snake is coiled, inactive, that's what I call Brahman. If it is moving, then that's what I call this world. Sri Ramakrishna says here, if you accept the Nitya, that is impersonal, you must also accept the Leela. It is the process of negation and affirmation. You realize the Nitya by negating the Leela. Then you affirm the Leela, seeing in it the manifestation of the same impersonal. One attains this state after realizing reality in both aspects, personal and impersonal. The personal is the embodiment of chit, consciousness, and the impersonal is the indivisible Satchidananda. Brahman alone has become everything. Therefore, to the Vijnani, this world is a mansion of mirth. It is he alone who has become the universe, living beings, and the 24 cosmic principles. When he is actionless, I call him Brahman. When he creates, preserves and destroys, I call him Shakti. Brahman and Shakti are not different from each other. Water is water, whether it is still or moving. This special state of recognizing, realizing but one reality is called, so Sri Ramakrishna calls it Vijnana, a specialized knowledge. And as I said, many people mistake. There is a conflict between reasoning and feeling, religion and science, between many religions, between the personal and the impersonal, between the theory and knowledge. So the Upanishad is trying to reconcile and say, both are good, both yield their own result, but that result would be incomplete. Only when these two are completely reconciled, with the help of this manifested world, we can destroy what you call the obstacles. With the contemplation on the impersonal, we become one with it. The idea is that there is no conflict at all between science and religion, theory and practice, and reason and faith, between different yogas, between different religions. If you study the history of religion, you find how much of hatred, how much of bloodshed is going on even today. How much of hatred between the followers of different sects, Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, and within them there are infinite number of sects. I was reading the history of South Africa recently, and there it is said that whom they call Boers, the Dutch people who had gone into South Africa and settled there, they found these black people, and they considered these black people as like animals. Where from did they get this idea? Yet these Boers were strict followers of Old Testament. So it is written in the Old Testament that the people of God, whom they considered as themselves, they must completely enslave all the other people, what they call Canaanites. They must enslave them, and they must use them as servants. They have no equal rights along with them. And they believed it so sincerely that any movement to oppose this, to give equal rights to the blacks, have been completely smashed. The result was, for hundreds of years, so many black people have been completely killed. Similarly, in America, so many American Indians have been exterminated. In India, people, the Aryas means those who are fair complexioned, they have completely enslaved the Dasyus, or from the Dasyu came the word Dasa, servant, what whom you call now scheduled castes and scheduled tribes. They have been accepted after a long time as the fourth caste. In the beginning there were only three castes, and the fourth caste has to be used purely for the purpose of domestic work, like domestic animals. Slavery in a different form existed in India until recently. Even today you will find it. What they call, like Russia, they had this, what they call? Slave. They used to have the people permanently in their families as their bonded servants. Yeah, like that in India, even in my time I used to see, we had some servants whom we used to call Mala. That is, they can live only outside the village, and no interaction between the families, marriage and other things are out of the question. These are like bonded slaves. So for generations together, one family is attached to our lands. So their forefathers, they have to work there from their birth until their death. And they get a little bit of food and other things. Even today, many of the boys have been working like that in interior villages. So how could a man with reason really can enslave another human being? The reason is that they believed that the scriptures, the God himself made these people like that, and that is absolute gospel truth. Everywhere this thing has happened. But any man who wants to attain to spirituality, how can he ever distinguish not to speak of animals or other non-human beings? At least human beings, all human beings, to treat them as equally as manifestations of God. But so many saints have come, they try to teach to the people, don't have any look for any difference. Bhagavad Gita, one of the greatest scriptures which had shaped the modern Hinduism, and is even now influential very much, where it says, who is a wise man? A seer who sees a learned Brahmin and a cow and an elephant and an eater of a dog and a dog, all these he must look with equal eye. Otherwise, his realization is not complete. Vidya vinaya samparne brahmane gavihastini shunicheiva shvapakeja panditaha samadarshinaha samadarshana. Equal vision of seeing God in everything. It is a story of great saint Namadeva. He carried holy water to Rameshwaram. He was supposed to bathe the deity there with that holy Ganges water, brought all the way walking from Varanasi. Just as he was about to enter the temple, he saw a donkey dying of thirst. So straight he went. So many people were protesting. Oh, all your merit you have acquired carrying this holy water all the way from Banaras will be completely lost to you. He said, this is my Lord Vishwanatha. Here is a living creature. It is dying of thirst. And this, I will get more merit through this than through anything else. So he gave the water to the donkey. These kind of saints have come throughout the ages to teach us this ennobled vision of seeing the same reality in everything. Even for Swami Vivekananda, who was the preacher of this modern Vedanta, of seeing the same Brahman, same God in everything, which is the basis which could remove all our quarrels, differences, and hopefully make us better people, even he had difficulty in his life to reconcile this vision with his own convictions. Those of you who are familiar, you know, when he first came to Sri Ramakrishna, he criticized Sri Ramakrishna. Oh, he still goes to the temple. He is an idolater. He worships the idols. And Sri Ramakrishna smiles and says, a day will come when you will thirst for these very idols. And the day came. So he had Nirvikalpa Samadhi. After that he went on a wandering life. During his travels, he came across a so-called low-caste man smoking a hookah. And he felt a desire to smoke. So he went and asked, can I smoke from your hookah? The man said, I am a low-caste man. You will incur sin. I will incur sin if I give it to you. And unconsciously, you know, the tremendous force of past impressions. Yes, he is a low-caste man and I should not touch anything touched by him. Nothing conscious, everything unconscious. He walked off for 2-3 miles. Then suddenly he came, I am a knower of Brahman. How come that I can make this differentiation? He came back and deliberately smoked to get rid of this idea. Even then, that idea did not disappear from his mind. So he was wandering in the northern India. He was invited as a guest of the Raja of Khetri, and the Khetri Maharaja arranged for his entertainment a dance by a Nauch girl. And when the king invited him to come and enjoy this entertainment, Swamiji refused because he had that idea that this is a woman and a monk should never have been entertained by a woman, especially by Nauch girls. And this God wanted to remove that inequality, that whom do you call a woman? A knower of Brahman cannot make such a distinction. This is a man, this is a woman. Anybody who can make such a distinction, it is not difficult for him to fall, slip down and make further distinctions. This is Hindu, so he is very good. This is a Brahmin, this is excellent. Hindus used to consider all foreigners as vlechas. Do you know that? Why? Because they eat meat. Not knowing, the forefathers of these Hindus were used to gobble up well-grown bulls. This is Swami Vivekananda used to say, two rishis could polish off a medium-grown bull. But these accretions came later on. This cow is very sacred. But what about chicken? What about fish?
What about other animals? Are they not sacred? What is the difference? I mean, Hindus, if you ask, would you like to eat beef? You say, no, it is a great sin. What about fish or chicken? Oh, that will be all right. What is the difference? Both are living creatures. You are giving pain to both the creatures. If you can eat one, why can't you eat the other? Can you defend it rationally? No. Then, by what are you going? By your feeling, by your tradition, by your culture. Swami Vivekananda was also going by that culture, that a woman should be only contacted only in emergencies, only while accepting food. Because men don't cook and give food. It is only the women who do it. So, Swami Vivekananda refused to come. This lady, rather, Sri Ramakrishna, our Divine Mother, wanted to make Swami Vivekananda's vision equal. Just imagine, if he had still those differences persisting, could he have ever come to the West? Could he have met the Western disciples? Most of the people who supported Swami Vivekananda in the West were women. Without them, he would have been completely lost. So this girl started singing a song, Prabhu Mere Avaguna Chittanadharo. O Lord, do not look at the bad qualities within me. Samadarashi Hai Namatiharu. Your name is equal sighted. In the eyes of God, there is no man or woman. They are all my children. Good, bad, all are my children. Ultimately, they will all come to me. Swami Vivekananda's vision of equality was complete with that lesson. Thereafter, we never see any of such differentiations made by him. After that, throughout his wanderings, as Hindus or Muslims or Brahmins or fourth caste, he equally regarded all of them with the same eye. It is this vision which every religion wants us to take there. If this vision is lacking, then there is something very seriously wrong. So the Upanishad particularly is mentioning these problems, so we have to guess that even these differentiations existed even in those times. There were people who were devoted to rituals, and by the time the Upanishadic lore had come into vogue, they have completely rebelled. Some of the Upanishads have completely rebelled. Especially we see the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Though it contains the heights of spiritual realization, mystical realization, if we study in between the lines, we also find ridiculing those who are practitioners of rituals. Oh, they go to the third class worlds. This world is an illusion. Sri Ramakrishna never entertained such an idea. For him, this world is a manifestation of God. When he opens his eyes, then he sees the Divine Mother in various forms. When he closes his eyes, not in our sense, we close our eyes and still see the world much more than what we see with open eyes. When we go beyond the mind, it is the same truth. When we function through the body and mind, it is the same truth, but as seen through the glasses of the body and mind. The highest vision is to find equality between these two. So, the conflict between theory and practice, rituals and knowledge, science versus religion, action versus contemplation, and differences between various religions, conflicts between different yogas, all these are completely unreasonable. What is the best way? Best way is to reconcile action and contemplation, reason and faith, science and religion, theory and practice. This is what Swami Vivekananda had in mind, and that is what he preached. That's why his Vedanta is called Neo-Vedanta. What is the meaning of Neo? There was a great deal of discussion. What exactly does the word Neo means? Is it that he had differed from the old Vedantic theories? Yes and no. The interpretation given to Vedanta by successive number of acharyas like Shankara, Ramanuja, Madhva, he had differed from them in a way. But the Vedanta that has been originally preached by the Upanishads, especially like the statements of the Isavasya Upanishad, which we are discussing now. He had brought back that old seer's vision into the modern world. So there are some people who rebel against technology, as though technology is the greatest killer or murderer or that which sets us back. Some people would like to go into the woodlands, and we are in contact with nature. We have nothing to do with the electricity and other things and all that. But strangely, they carry a modern packed camp. I don't know, that is, they don't know that that is also the result of the modern technology. They carry their wristwatches, they carry their mobile phones, but they don't want other things. The next three verses go into a little more depth. The differences not only that are existing in this visible universe, but the more of these differences that exist between the concept of deity itself, that also has got to be removed. So the Upanishad goes on telling, Andhantama pravishanti ye asambhutim upasate tato bhuya yavate tamo yav sambhutya amrataha anyadevahu sambhavat anyadahu asambhavat iti sushruma dhiranam ye nastad vichachakshare sambhutincha vinashancha yastad vedo bhayam saha vinashena mrutyam tirthva sambhutya amrutam ashnute. That is, the translation is into a blind darkness they enter who worship only the unmanifested, but into a greater darkness they enter who worship the manifested Hiranyagarbha. One thing they say is obtained from the worship of the manifested, another they say from the worship of the unmanifested. Thus we have heard from the wise who taught us this. He who knows that both the unmanifested and the manifested should be worshipped together overcomes death by the worship of the manifested and obtains immortality through devotion to the unmanifested. So here is another type of conflict. What is the conflict? The conflict between the impersonal and the personal. The conflict between knowledge and devotion. Of course, in the West, as we understand it, there was little manifestation only of this conflict. But in India, there have been mainly two types of paths which have been emphasized. The path of knowledge and the path of devotion. Those who follow the path of knowledge look down upon those who follow the path of devotion as, oh, they are good for nothing people. They can go only and chanting. And those who follow the path of devotion remark about the other fellows, oh, they are dry fellows, dry as dry wood, dry sticks. We call them dry sticks. This is one of our Swamis was a humorous man. And he has a theory, all those who have got terrible stomach problems, they follow the path of knowledge. Because they can't enjoy anything and they can't see others also enjoying it. Dry as sticks. But humor apart, we see in the life of Sri Ramakrishna how this conflict was affecting people so deep. Even among those who are considered to be highly advanced in spiritual life. For example, when Sri Ramakrishna had completed the devotional path, Totapuri had arrived on this scene. And Totapuri wanted to give Sri Ramakrishna monastic vows and lead him through the path of the impersonal. So his guru, who had been lovingly teaching him the path of devotion, in the path of the tantras, she became very grave and she forbade him, don't enter into that path, it is a very dry path, there are no feelings, all your devotion will be destroyed. On the other hand, Sri Ramakrishna of course did not listen to his guru's words. Why? Because he had gone to the very source of truth. For him, the Divine Mother was the truth. Not as we understand, but as he understands it. Divine, by Divine Mother, he doesn't mean that figure that we see at Dakshineswar, the Mother Kali. Oh, he is worshipping Mother Kali. Those who read carefully the biography of Sri Ramakrishna, the great master, the very first vision that he had, a few months after he assumed the priestship of the worship of the Mother Kali, he was longing for the vision of the Divine Mother. And Mother was not gracious enough. Then one day he felt he should commit suicide because he was not having the vision of the Mother. And at that time he was in the temple, his eyes fell on the sword and he ran like one mad to cut his throat because he was not having the vision of the Mother. As he took the sword into his hands, he lost consciousness. The description given of that vision is very revealing, that waves of consciousness as it were rolling down towards him from all sides, and he was struggling not to lose his consciousness. Psychological language, you know, he was being overwhelmed by waves of consciousness, and he was struggling not to lose his consciousness. What was that consciousness he was struggling against, and what was the consciousness which was struggling to engulf him? It is the consciousness of limitations is to be completely drowned by the consciousness of the pure reality, Brahman. That means one has to go beyond the mind, the dichotomy between the subject and the object. The whole world of duality, as it were, is to be completely overcome. But he failed. These waves of consciousness completely engulfed him. Then after 2-3 days he came back to normal consciousness, and he was heard to utter Ma, 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 Mother, Mother, Mother. Swami Sharadananda puts a small remark there. Says, what does he mean by the Mother? Mother Kali, Divine Mother. As soon as we read it, what do we think of that Divine Mother, Mother Kali? No. It is the personalized God. This whole world remains transformed into that of the Divine Mother. We can never understand Sri Ramakrishna's usage of the words like Divine Mother. At least intellectually, we should try to lift up our understanding. It's not particularized form. It is the whole manifested reality, as it were, combined together, which goes in Vedanta by the name of Ishvara. This word cannot be translated excepting by saying it is the whole manifested universe. That's all. So Sri Ramakrishna had that vision. And so it is not the particularized form of Kali or any particular image. It is consciousness as perceived, pure consciousness as perceived through the limitations of the mind, concepts. That's what he used to call the Divine Mother. So, this Bhairavi Brahmani's guru did not understand. She thought, by following that path, he will lose whatever spirituality he had. Now, what is so surprising is that she had a vision of Sri Ramakrishna as her chosen deity. She used to worship Sri Rama as her chosen deity. When she first met Sri Ramakrishna, they had a wonderful talk in the morning. Then for a long time they had a talk. Then she went away to the Panchavati to have her noonday meal. And it was her habit, before eating, she would offer the food to her chosen deity and meditate. When she offered her food and started meditating, Sri Ramakrishna was in his room, which is about 5 minutes away from that place. He had an urge, indescribable urge, to go towards that Panchavati. Unconsciously, he walked there and the food was lying there and he started eating it. The food that Bhairavi was offering to her own chosen deity, Sri Ramakrishna stood there and started eating. This is a wonderful thing we can imitate. At least one teaching of Sri Ramakrishna we can follow. Then Bhairavi Brahmani opened her eyes. What did she see? She saw her chosen deity accepting her offering in the form of Sri Ramakrishna. And yet the same lady had forgotten when the time came. She presumed to teach him, don't walk that path. It is not suitable for you. But Sri Ramakrishna, he never listens to anybody. He listens only to truth. If others confirm to the truth, that's fine. If they differ, then he would follow the truth alone. He went straight to the mother and said, what shall I do? Shall I follow this teacher of knowledge? She said, yes, it is for this purpose I have brought him here. So he followed, and as soon as Totapuri finished his teaching of the path of knowledge, everything is Brahman, and asked him to meditate, immediately he plunged into meditation. And his guru was surprised. Said, for 40 years I had struggled to attain to this state of samadhi. How come this man had attained it immediately? That's fine. That's understandable. But what followed then? Sri Ramakrishna came out of that samadhi, and it was his custom at dawn and dusk to go around the pictures of all the gods and goddesses, clap his hands, or if he is sitting outside, just at dawn and dusk, he would sit, clap his hands, and go on chanting various names of God, Ganga, Gayatri, Gita, Kali, Om, Krishna, Govinda, etc., etc. And his teacher, who was supposed to have attained that highest vision of Nirvikalpa Samadhi, in Vedantic terminology, Nirvikalpa Samadhi is the highest that one can attain. There is nothing beyond that. It is going beyond mind. Once a person attains that, nobody is there to ask, is there something beyond it? So that very person, he became bewildered and said, what? Are you fashioning chapatis? And Sri Ramakrishna retorted and said, you rascal, I am taking mother's name. And how dare you call that I am fashioning chapatis? His clapping of the hands is like fashioning the chapatis. This is the illustration. We find even that highest man of samadhi could not comprehend what Sri Ramakrishna was doing. He attained that state of vijnana, where he could see that which is beyond the mind is also what we perceive through our five sense organs. Not as we worldly people perceive, but the same Brahman, the same reality is perceived through this. So he had no conflict, but his guru had the conflict. And the guru had to stay for 11 months at Dakshineswar to learn the lesson, which completed his realization that whether one opens the eyes or closes the eyes, a man of realization sees the same truth, should see the same truth. That was the lesson Sri Ramakrishna had taught. So you see, our ingrained habits, however noble they may be, how much they can lead us into trouble if we do not reconcile reason and faith. Faith is fine. Feelings are fine. But if these feelings are not justified by reason and rationality, they can lead us into deep trouble. Even I am surprised that a great historian who was never considered as a great spiritual person, even through his rationality, he could come to the same conclusion. I'm talking about Arnold Toynbee, how the Christians who preach that it is the one God whom they are all calling, how could they try to convert other people into their religion? If they truly believed that God is only one, then whom they are worshipping must be the same God whom Hindus or Muslims or Buddhists are also calling. What is the point in conversion? In conversion is, my religion is superior to your religion. How is my religion superior to your religion? Because my Jesus Christ, only through him one can enter the kingdom of heaven. But what about the Hindus bowing down before the stones or images? What about the Buddhists who never talk about God? Where do they go? You see, so much of conflict comes. How does this Upanishad help us practically? We can have feelings. There are people here among us who have feelings, emotions. But if these emotions are not controlled by reason, then there will be a lot of troubles. Most of the problems that occur, be in our families, in our offices, in monasteries, and in every place that we see, are problems of the superiority of feelings against reason. If we can cultivate these two, a man who has reason but no feeling, he is dry. A person who has got only feelings, their emotions, without controlling the factor of the reason, he will also suffer. And perhaps he will suffer much more than the person of reason without feelings. Given a choice, whether one should have only either reason or feelings, I think I would prefer reason than feelings. Too many emotions destroy our life. Feelings can give temporary joy, but they also plunge us into the depths of suffering, misery, and all that. Then what is the truth? Why is the Upanishad telling that we must reconcile all these things? The conflict between the personal and the impersonal, between faith and reason, between the science and religion, between various sects. The truth is that the highest truth ever remains unknowable or unknown. It is not unknowable really. It can be experienced, but it can never be known as we understand to know. It's not an object. You cannot objectify God. Whatever ideas we are having about God is not God. They are just ideas in our minds, the concepts. Hinduism or Vedanta has recognized that there are three concepts of God. Any human being at any given time, whatever concept he may have about God, can be classified into these three categories. The lowest category is God is with forms, with qualities. The next higher concept is that God is without form but with infinite qualities. And the highest concept, if at all it has to be called a concept, is that he is without forms, therefore without names, he is without any qualities, he is what Vedanta calls in one simple word, nirvisesha, qualityless. Qualityless doesn't mean that he doesn't have qualities. It means he has infinite qualities. Vedanta has developed a special way of convincing this truth to us. Certain terms that we use from ordinary point of understanding can create misunderstanding. God is formless doesn't mean he is formless. What it means is he comprises that very basic thing which contains within it any conceivable form. God is without qualities doesn't mean that he is without qualities. It means he is the source of all qualities. To give a simple example, Vedanta uses this. Here is a lump of clay. What form does it have? No form. But it contains infinite forms. You can make a pot out of it. You can make a glass out of it. Whatever form you can choose to have, you can bring out of that lump of clay, or putty, let us say putty. We all play with putty, isn't it, at schools? It's just a lump of putty. You can make any form, a horse, a cow, a man, a flower, anything you want. But when it is in the form of just a lump, is it having any form? And yet, is it without form? All the forms that a human being can conceive of are simply there. I am reminded of a beautiful incident from the life of Michelangelo. You know, he was one of the greatest Greek sculptors, Roman sculptors. So there was he was a budding sculptor at that time. Only few people know him. There were others who were more famous. And there was a family called Medici, the Medici family, which used to commission, in those days rich people, they commission, you make the sculpture for our house and we will give you so much money. It's called commissioning. So this Medici family once wanted to commission a beautiful sculpture on some occasion. So Michelangelo also participated in the application, he also applied whether he could be given the commission, but naturally he was rejected. Another man got the commission. So that sculptor went to the mountains and picked up one of the biggest blocks of marble. You know, Italy is very famous for marbles. And from outside, the marble block looked absolutely perfect, marvelous, shiny. It was the best he could get at that time. So the whole block that man chipped off, brought it there, started for his work. As soon as a little bit of work he had done, he found a huge, big crack underneath that block. From his point of view, it was a completely useless piece of marble, because what he wanted to do, he could not do out of it. So he just threw it into the scrap yard. And Michelangelo was desolate, disconsolate, because he could not get the commission, but he had tremendous ambition to become one of the biggest sculptors. So he was poor also at that time, and in fact he remained poor most of the time. So he was going around these scrap heaps to get a small piece of marble for his own experimentations, practice. And he found this huge block with this crack. So he asked the scrap heaper, is it for sale? And the scrap heaper also was looking for a customer because it was lying down uselessly like junk. And he said, take it at a cheap rate, maybe 50 pence or something like that. And he was very glad to get rid of it. So Michelangelo brought it to his home, and there the creative genius of Michelangelo manifested itself. What was it? What is the difference between creative people and non-creative people? Non-creative people, in the modern terminology, De Bono always says, you know, creative thinking. Many books are there. Creative thinking. Be a creative thinker. The conventional thinking is linear thinking. So the old man, old sculptor was looking, I wanted to do this, but this piece is useless for my purpose. That was his linear way of thinking. Whereas Michelangelo stood before it and said, what can I do with it? Two ways of looking at the same thing. So he did not say, I want to make this, so whether it is useful or not. He looked at it and said, this is like this. What can I do with this? What is the best that I can do with this? And immediately in his creative mind flashed the figure of Goliath, David killing the Goliath. You know, that huge figure with two legs like this, astride. So he thought, this is a wonderful block which would suit my purpose of sculpting the Goliath, the David killing the Goliath. And out came the most marvelous sculpture for which he became so famous today. Even today it is there. I think in Florence or somewhere it is there. Now the point is that instead of thinking that God should be like this, like this, like this, we should be able to come, this is a concept. What is the best concept that I can have with my limited vision? So, God is not a concept. Concept is not a God. Concept is just a bridge, a pathway, a doorway that leads us. So, to illustrate this fact, as I said, Vedanta always says that God is beyond names, beyond forms, and he cannot be distinguished as this or that. To distinguish anything, there must be at least two things present. When there is only one thing, you cannot distinguish it. In language also we use that. Suppose there is only one book in my cupboard. I simply say, bring the book. Supposing there are two copies of the same book, one with my handwritten notes and with a red cover, and the other just lying there. Then I use the language, you bring that book red with red cover where I have filled it up with my notes. So, when Vedanta says God is without names, without forms, without qualities, it is not a denial of these things, but it is to say it is the very source from which all names, all forms, all qualities have come down. Now, I said these are the three concepts. God with forms, with names, and with qualities. God without form, but with infinite qualities. And God beyond all these distinctions. These are the three concepts. Any human being, at any given time, whatever concept he has of God, must fall within one of these three categories. But at the same time, Vedanta is warning us that the truth is beyond the mind and speech. These are concepts that help you to reach that highest truth. And once you reach that truth, automatically you have to discard all these concepts. You have to rise beyond the concepts. How does this work? First of all, we have to live with so many people. We have to adjust with so many people. There is bound to be conflict of opinions. Why is the conflict opinion? Each man is helpless. As Bhagavad Gita says, that each man is bound by his own nature, by his birth, by his past impressions, by his culture, by his tradition. But if we do not recognize that we are already bound by these things, we take all these things as gospel truths, my culture is best, my idea is best, my religion is best, then it is bound to create problems. The same thing works not only in religion, but also in day-to-day life. One man sees a thing in a different way. I see it in a different way. The conflict is between these two. I am unable to put myself in the shoes of the other man and look at things from his point of view. Suppose somebody is quarreling with me. Now what is the point of trying to quarrel with that man? It will only increase the quarrel. It is not certainly going to bring about any peace. But we say, well, the other person looks at things in his own way. I am looking at this way. This is a difference. Let us see what best we can do under these circumstances. So even in ordinary day-to-day life, this understanding of accepting everybody is looking at things, at the world, at ourselves in a different way, can help us enormously to bring about better understanding, at least, than what it is now. But in the field of religion and spirituality, it goes much deeper than that. First thing I recognize, everybody's concept of God is just a concept. It is an idea in the mind. So we should never condemn or criticize or disrespect anybody else. Secondly, even I have to recognize, even my own concept of my own God or God is only my own concept. It may be good, it is helping us, helping me, but it is not the truth. It is the truth as I conceive of it now with my limitations. The attempt should be to go beyond these limitations. And that's what the lesson we learn from Rabia. Rabia was being severely criticized by people. And somebody asked her, that are you not bothered that people are criticizing you? She simply said, I love God so much, I have no time to think of what other people are thinking about me. The simple point is, if we are busy with our own practice and with sincerity, then the right understanding comes. Most of the problems would be solved there itself. There is a joke, you know. A man went to a hotel and he sat down, ordered something. And there was another young man who was so curious to know about this other person. Went on poking what he is eating, what he is doing and all that. So the other man noticed it, didn't say anything. After a few minutes, he took down a slip of paper and wrote something there, put it on his chair and went out for a few minutes. The other man could not contain his curiosity. So he went there, took up that slip quickly and opened it. What is written there? But mind your own business. If we mind our own business, if we are sincerely devoting ourselves to our own practice, and this practice must bring about transformation, our tolerance, our forgiveness, our prayer for others. There was a wonderful incident from the life of Latu Maharaj. Latu Maharaj, you know, Swami Adbhutananda, supposed to be an illiterate man. But Sri Ramakrishna told him, from your very illiteracy will come the truths of Veda and Vedanta. It's a wonderful life. Sri Ramakrishna tried to educate him, but all his education stopped with the beginning of consonants. The question came, how could Sri Ramakrishna, the world, master of the world, how could he fail to educate one single man, his own disciple, and who was so sincere? The one interpretation of it is, Sri Ramakrishna wanted to teach to the people, to us, that what we call academic education, scriptural knowledge, is not really necessary for the apprehension of the truth. If Latu Maharaj had learned, became academically educated, started studying books, then this truth would not have been so self-evident. So, later on, Swami Adbhutananda became wonderful. When he was staying in our ashrama, perhaps at Varanasi, there was a quarrel among the inmates in the monastery. So one of the people who quarreled also, and he came to Latu Maharaj. And Latu Maharaj was advising him, what type of meditation are you doing? If you cannot stop quarreling within yourselves, then your meditation is completely useless. Because even you may differ with the other person, but there should be never dislike or hatred or anything like that. On the other hand, you should have the constant prayer, let everyone advance towards God. Every sincere spiritual aspirant, others may persecute him, but if he is a genuine spiritual aspirant, his only prayer would be that since I believe that going towards God is the highest thing that a man can do in human life, that may I wish that all my so-called people who dislike me, enemies, may they also advance towards God. The more one advances towards God, the less will be the differences of opinion. Sri Ramakrishna used to say, true spiritual progress alone can bring peace and bliss in this world. There is no other way. This is what the Upanishad is trying to tell us, that let people worship God in an impersonal way. Let people worship God with the lowest types of forms, idolatry. It doesn't matter. In what way people worship God is irrelevant. What is relevant is, are you apprehending the truth? Are you progressing towards the truth? Are you able to perceive the same reality within everyone, within everything? So when a person attains to that highest state of vision, he finds absolutely no difference between this manifested world and that unmanifested reality. But combining these two, even before we start our practice, is a good way of ensuring peace and happiness, less conflict, etc. This is a wonderful thing for us. If we keep this in mind, then there would be less quarrels, less conflicts of opinions. But one thing, I always find it very useful. Emotions must always be subdued, controlled with reason, with rationality. And ultimately, if we are busy minding our own business, then most of the problems will automatically drop off. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.